It's a very nice place. My first time here. So indeed, I'll tell you something about what one can do, hopefully with non-abelian anions, which has nothing to do with their non-abelian anionic properties, really, or hardly anything. But I will mention their non-abelian properties as well, but I think the gist of the talk will be about something else. So before I run out of time, let me actually mention my collaborators. The main collaborator is David Clark, who was really a driving force behind a couple of projects that I'm going to tell you about, who started working on this as my postdoc at UC Riverside and has since moved to Caltech, where he's finishing his postdoc with Jason Alicia. And Jason Alicia, of course, who worked with us on all this stuff. And so what I'm going to tell you about has something to do, as I said, the non-abelian statistics will not be the main part of it, but it will play some role in it. And so, of course, the statistics, just a very quick introduction into what that is. The original question was posed by Pauli. What happens when you take two particles and exchange them? Basically, how you can relate the wave function upon the exchange of two particles to the old wave function. And we all know the answer that in three dimensions for point particles, and that's kind of important because there are various ways of that are being developed now that try to get out of that conundrum. But if the particles are strictly point particles with no Dirac strings or anything like that attached to them, then we can only have bosons and fermions, and the proof of that is rather trivial. It's basically, instead of looking at the operation itself, what you want to do is to look at the square of the operation, which is equivalent topologically to just taking one particle around the other and bringing it back. And if you have all three dimensions available to you, then this path can actually be reduced, well, kind of lifted, if you wish, out of the plane and shrunk to nothing. That means that the square of the operation is then equivalent to a trivial operation, and that leads to basically the operation itself having only two eigenvalues, plus or minus one, hence bosons or fermions. Now, of course, that has a number of fundamental consequences. People like pointing out, neutron stars, Bose-Einstein condensate superconductors. I think far more important for us existing is the fermionic exchange statistics because it's the stability of matter that follows from that. None of these cute things, but us actually being here. Now, in two dimensions, this logic doesn't work because there is no way in which you can reduce this operation to a trivial operation without actually dragging this path through the location of another particle, and that opens the opportunity for having anions. And lastly, and I'll come back to this time allowing, in strictly speaking, in one dimension, exchange is not well defined because there is just no way you can exchange particles without having them collide with one another. Let me very quickly go over some important features of anions in two dimensions. And the concept was introduced back by Linus and Mirheim, and soon thereafter followed by Frank Wilczek, who coined the term anions. And the idea is that, the first anions that people thought about were abelian anions, and these are the particles for which the exchange can result in some phase rather than just plus or minus one as it would have been for bosons and fermions. These abelian anions have actually been observed in fractional quantum Hall systems, and fractional quantum Hall systems will be important for the rest of this talk, so I'll just spend really a couple of minutes describing the very basics that we might need for those of you who have never seen them or who have we don't have much familiarity with them. But before I go there, I want to mention something that is a toy model of abelian anions that was introduced by Frank Wilczek, who actually coined the term anions. And what he proposed back in his paper in 92 was creating a particle, a dionic particle, that combines a flux tube and a charge Q. And then if you look at taking one particle around the other and calculate the Aronov bomb phase that is acquired by this particle, then, well, in the units where h bar and c are both 1, this Aronov bomb phase would be just charge times the flux. Well, in fact, it's twice that because you also take a flux tube around the charge. And so you acquire this abelian phase, or just phase. And the important feature here to notice is that if your charge is quantized, if your charge is a multiple of the electron charge, and your flux is a multiple of the fundamental flux quantum, then the product of these two can only give you multiples of 2 pi. So you don't deserve anything interesting unless you manage to fractionalize either charge or flux or both. And that's even this toy model shows this rather important feature. And in fact, where this feature is actually realized is the fractional quantum Hall effect. And so that's a picture I stole from the Wikipedia of what the Hall effect is about. You take a slab of material, you stick it in a strong magnetic field, and you try to run the current. And of course, purely classically, the Lorentz force pushes the current to one side of the sample, creating a transverse electric field or transverse voltage. And if you do any classical, so this calculation can be done in many ways. Perhaps the simplest is just to do a Lorentz transformation into the reference frame where there's no electric field. But however you do it, you end up with the result that the Hall conductivity is basically proportional to the magnetic field and inversely proportional to the concentration of your carriers. And of course, that would predict a straight line on this plot. But what you see is not really a straight line. What you see is a series of steps. These steps correspond to various, so it's this line you should be looking at that is supposed to be straight, but isn't. And what you see, as I mentioned, is a series of steps with the most pronounced steps corresponding to the filling factor being an integer. And filling factor is an important quantity in characterizing quantum Hall states. And it's basically, so we can just massage the classical expression for the Hall conductivity into this expression where nu, the filling factor, is literally the number of electrons divided by the number of flux quanta that penetrate your sample. Or you can alternatively think about this as the number of field Landau levels. And so it turns out that whenever that number is an integer, well, where is an integer here? 1. You have an integer quantum Hall plateau. And then later on, it was realized that whenever this filling is a simple ratio, you also see plateaus like 1/3 is the most prominent on this plot. And in fact, if I didn't put the numbers, you wouldn't even know the difference between 1 and 1/3 here because they kind of look the same. One other important feature to notice here is that whenever the Hall conductivity, that is the transverse conductivity, experiences a plateau, the other plot here, the Jaggert line, is the longitudinal conductivity. That one drops down to zero. Actually, well, it's resistivity that drops down to zero, but it's a tensor, so both conductivity and resistivity, diagonal resistivity, becomes zero. What that means is that the current doesn't flow in the direction of the electric field, and there is no electric field in the direction of the current. So both resistivity and conductivity turn to zero. Now, how does that help us? Well, in fact, if the only thing you saw was this plot, you would already, with some thinking, realize that that's a fertile playground for finding anions. How does that follow from this plot? Well, basically what you can do is imagine the following thought experiment. Having your two-dimensional sample and driving one flux quantum through adiabatically. So locally, you increase the magnetic field until you get one flux quantum. Now, if you do your Maxwell equations right, you realize that there is also a curl of E that should correspond to the time derivative of B while you were increasing the magnetic field. And so there was an electric field circling the location of the flux insertion. And of course, you are in the quantum Hall regime. So if you're at one of the plateaus, that means that As I said, the current doesn't flow in the direction of the electric field. It flows strictly perpendicular to the electric field. That's actually what you learn from that quantum Hall trace that I've shown you. And if you're at a plateau, you know exactly what the value of the Hall conductivity is. It's this number nu, the filling factor E squared over H. And so you can actually calculate rather simply how much charge has been pushed from the away from the location of your flux insertion. And if you do that, you would find out that now there is, well, that was done very adiabatically. There is an overall depletion of charge, which is nu times E. So if you are at a plateau at nu equals 1/3, that means that 1/3 of the electron charge has flown away. So now look at this and realize that that basically realizes Wilczek-Stoy model, which is a flux quantum bound to some fractional charge. And because the charge is fractional in this case, you do deserve non-trivial statistics. So without telling you anything about the physics of quantum Hall, I kind of at least try to convince you that anions should naturally arise there. Now, and you can do the math in a more careful way, and you would find indeed the statistical angle, the phase that you acquire upon exchange for the fractional quantum Hall at nu equals 1 over m would be, these are the Laughlin states, would be just 2 pi over m. Now, the non-abelian anions, these are the ones that I'm really interested in, somewhat more complicated. And in order to have them, the essential ingredient is to have a degenerate ground state. Well, I'm not sure whether we can call it a ground state, but a degenerate, well, I guess, given locations of two particles, quasi-particles, so that's not a global ground state of your system, but imagine you created two particles, pin them to given locations, and the ground state for this system now with two particles in it should be degenerate. So there should be more than one wave function describing that corresponding to the same energy, describing two particles in the same locations. And then, of course, nothing in the laws of quantum mechanics prohibits you from being able to mix these states when you exchange the two particles. And if you think about this for 5 seconds, you realize that that's basically a matrix operation. And so now any exchanging of particles is a multiplication of a vector or a spinner in your degenerate subspace by a matrix. And matrices need not commute. And therefore, in principle, if they don't, you get non-abelian statistics. And the question is, of course, do these particles exist in nature? And by now, we are almost certain that they exist in several physical systems. My favorite would be nu equals 5/2 quantum Hall state, but that's not the one I'm going to talk about. What I will talk about is something that is closer related to so-called Majorana zero modes that have been they made quite a splash in the last couple of years. So what about Majorana zero modes? So without going deep into the details of the original Majorana construction, I'll just mention that a year before his mysterious disappearance, Majorana basically addressed the question of whether or not one can find a purely real solution to the Dirac equations. What that means is that a particle, a fermion, would be also its own antiparticle. And as far as we are concerned for condensed matter setting, that means that the operator for, let's say, annihilation of this particle should be the same as the operator for the creation of this particle. So that's basically our version of constructing a self-conjugate particle. That immediately implies, of course, that gamma squared is equal to 1. And formally, we can actually construct such an operator right away, given a fermionic, a conventional fermionic operator C. So if you just take C and add C Dugger, you realize that it actually satisfies these rules. And so that means that from the point of view of condensed metaphysicists, a Majorana fermion or a Majorana zero mode should be simply a particle that is, So in order to construct a normal conventional fermion, what you need is two Majorana modes. because this one is encompasses both C and C dagger, and so you need another one to just extract pure C out of that. And so in some sense, this Majorana fermion is, I don't know, people refer to it as half a square root of a fermion, but I think it's both a little bit misleading, and what's important for us to notice is basically this that tells me that it's actually an equal amplitude superposition or equal weight superposition of an electron and a hole. And what that means in the context of condensed matter is that we actually need a superconductor. And without naming names, I know that there are some attempts of finding Majoranas in systems without superconductivity, which I think are deeply misguided, because superconductor is an essential feature of a localized Majorana mode, simply because it should allow you to mix an electron and a hole, which under normal circumstances is not allowed because they have different charge and you can't really create superpositions of different superselection sectors. But a superconductor, of course, only conserves charge modulo 2e. And from that point of view, minus E and E is the same thing and can be mixed easily. All right. So now, of course, speaking of the splash that Majorana fermions have made recently, so there were successive announcements from Nature, which I do not, I'm just listing them here, but I leave all the comments outside of my talk. It's possibly that what has been found on Majorana fermions, I wouldn't go as far as calling it a solid case, but let's leave it there. So let me very quickly review the system in which these Majorana zero modes have been found. And let me start from a one-dimensional toy model that was introduced in a somewhat overlooked paper by Alexei Kitaev in 2001 that really wasn't noticed for the next, I don't know, almost 10 years after he wrote this, well, 9 or 8 years after he wrote that paper. What he proposed is basically a model which is a one-dimensional model of spinless fermions with a hopping term and a superconducting pairing term. And because these fermions are spinless, it's necessarily a p-wave superconductor. You can also see this by simply switching the order of these two operators. Because of the fermionic anti-commutation rule, it has to change sign, so that means that delta is anti-symmetric upon exchange. So this is a genuine p-wave superconductor. And for this model, you can do a very simple analysis. Well, this is quadratic one-dimensional model, so you can just find anything you may want to find, but instead of diagonalizing it exactly, I'll just look at one specific easy-to-understand case where the chemical potential is equal to zero and the tunneling amplitude is equal to the pairing amplitude. And as I already mentioned to you a few slides back, any fermionic operator can be written as a sum of two, or as a linear superposition of two Majorana operators, and reserving X to the location of the site on the lattice. A and B are the two Majorana fermions that you have to populate each side of your lattice with in order to construct a full-fledged fermionic operator. So now, at this particular point, it turns out that your Hamiltonian is simply a sum of these bilinear terms that couple A and B Majorana operators, but the way they couple them is rather interesting. They couple the B operator on one side to the A operator on the other side. And what that does, it leaves two Majorana operators, the very first one, the gamma A1, and the very last one, gamma Bn, outside of this Hamiltonian entirely. But what it also means is that you can take these two operators and construct another bilinear operator out of them, and that will commute with the Hamiltonian. And what that is, so these are Majorana, so-called Majorana zero modes. They are the generators of this degeneracy of the, or I should say the operator that I construct out of them is generates this double degeneracy of my chain. And what it physically means is that my superconducting chain is actually degenerate with respect to adding an extra fermion to this chain. So normally you cannot add an electron to a superconductor unless you pay the energy gap, but here you can do it for free. Now, it turns out, of course, that mathematically this model is identical to the easing model, to the transverse field easing model, and the only difference, so mathematically there is no difference between the two, but physically there is a big difference because you can obtain Majorana operators in the easing model just as well, but they wouldn't be local in terms of local degrees of freedom, in terms of spin degrees of freedom. On the other hand, these gammas are local in terms of the fermionic apparatus, and that's where the main difference is. So in that sense, people talk about this degeneracy, for example, as being topologically protected because you cannot mess up locally with these operators and change anything about the degeneracy. While for the easing model, you actually can, just owing to the non-local nature of operators whose algebra is exactly the same. All right, so now, of course, that's a toy model. We don't have one-dimensional spinless superconductors. But the next conceptual step, and that's the step that I will really exploit for the rest of this talk, was, as far as I'm concerned, made by Fu and Kane in 2008, who realized that basically the same physics can be realized on the edge of a two-dimensional topological insulator. And here is a caricature of that edge, which is basically an insulating state, which is just, insulating with nothing interesting happening on the edge. Contrast that to the quantum Hall state, which I already mentioned to you, which at this caricature level corresponds to localized orbits of electrons inside the volume, but then there is this skipping orbit or the chiral edge state that corresponds to the that always describes the edge of a quantum Hall state. And for a topological insulator, what you have is a quantum spin Hall state, and let me not go into the fine details of the difference between quantum spin Hall and topological insulator. For the purpose of my talk, the important thing is that I have two copies. So it's basically two copies of the quantum Hall state with two spins subjected to opposite magnetic fields. And so you have two copies of the same edge state, one moving to the, whatever the direction is, to the right with up spin, and the other one moves to the left with the down spin. Same picture basically two edge states corresponding to the opposite values of spin on the edge of a two-dimensional topological superconductor. So notice something really important. So if you focus on a single edge, it's not like spinless. Definitely there is a spin degree of freedom, but the spin degree of freedom is not an independent degree of freedom. It's actually tied to the direction of motion of particles. And from that point of view, as it turns out, and that's the only, so the important thing for realizing Kitaev's construction is not the spinlessness by itself. It's the fact that the spin is not an independent degree of freedom. And that is what is observed here. And so now if you play this game, and I wrote the edge Hamiltonian here. If you don't like looking at these, don't. The only important thing is that basically you have two gapless edge states counterpropagating, one for spin up, one for spin down. That's just the corresponding Hamiltonian. So this is effectively spinless part of the Hamiltonian. And now if we were to follow Kitaev's example, we would have to add a superconductor. So let's put an S-wave superconductor around. And in fact, the fact that the spin is there and the two edges correspond to the opposite spins is actually helpful because that allows one to proximitize this edge by an S-wave superconductor. You don't have to go P-wave. S-wave couples to the opposite spins quite well. That's the Hamiltonian now with the Cooper pairing. And then the edge now is this Kitaev wire, except it doesn't really have ends, so you have to create ends, and you do that by terminating a part of your edge by a ferromagnetic insulator. So if you don't want to go into the details of what's going on, this is really nothing other than terminating the edge and creating, therefore, sort of creating this Kitaev wire, and the two end points are just the Majorana zero modes. Now, if you want to be slightly more precise, you would say that S-wave superconductors and a ferromagnetic insulator open gaps with opposite masses, and then according to the Jakeev-Rebbe theorem, there should be a zero energy state pinned to the domain wall between them, and that's what these Majorana modes are at that level. Now, the actual realization itself. So there's time reversal symmetry, right? So in order to gap this, you have to violate one of the two symmetries. So it's either superconductor or ferromagnetic insulator that breaks the time reversal symmetry. So the edge of a topological insulator is protected by the time reversal symmetry. If you allow scattering with a spin flip, it will gap the edge, and that's exactly what happens here when you bring a ferromagnetic insulator in contact with the topological insulator. I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second. So maybe if you can postpone your question for 5 minutes, I'll come back to that. All right. So let me just very briefly mention what has been done experimentally. And experimentally, people didn't look at the edge of a two-dimensional topological insulator. That's sort of another modification of the same idea, of the Fouquet idea, by the Maryland group and Oreg Raphael and Van Oppen, who pointed out that you can just exploit strong spin orbit interactions in quantum wires. Even if you don't have a topological insulator, basically a spin orbit interaction, this term, the Rajbert term, shifts two parabolas that you would see for, this is just a single electron spectrum for this wire, with two parabolas corresponding to the two directions of spin along and in the direction opposite to the kx, to the momentum. And then if you add a Zeeman term, that opens the gap here. And now if you put the Fermi level somewhere in between this maximum and this minimum, you realize that the Fermi level only crosses two states, not four states. And that's kind of an important ingredient. So basically, you effectively got spin out of the picture. And now if you open, these two states have almost opposite directions of spin. And now if you proximitize this wire with a superconductor, you expect to get Majorana fermions, or this Majorana zero modes, at the ends of a superconductor. And that's basically exactly what has been done in now famous experiments of the Delft group. So these are all the pictures I've shown you. And the signature is a predicted signature. And this signature will be kind of important for us, is a so-called zero bias conductance peak. And I'll tell you a bit more about what the zero bias conductance peak is in a few minutes. But it's basically the notion that once you're trying to tunnel to the end of this wire, what you can see is, well, presumably this is the signatures of the superconducting gap. But at certain magnetic fields, there appears to be something right in the middle. So you can tunnel right at zero energy into a superconductor, which should be a signature of Majorana. Now, I wouldn't call it bulletproof. There are some other suggestions of what could result in this zero bias anomaly, but I don't want to focus on this. So these are the zero bias anomalies that were interpreted as a signature, possible signatures of Majoranas. Now, the question we tried to address, that was the longest introduction I ever gave. The question we tried to address was, can you get anything other than Majoranas in a similar setting? And at a first glance, the answer should be no. And the reason for that is that there was a series of papers, Fitkovsky, Kitaev, and Turner, Polman, and Berg, coming from different directions, argued that you can actually classify phases of interacting fermions in 1D, and it's a Z8 classification. The important thing for us is that it's stable with 8 entries. You can actually go through the table and ask yourself, well, what lives at the end of a one-dimensional system, and you don't find anything more interesting than Majoranas. And basically, I told David just that when he started asking questions about whether or not we can find something more interesting than Majoranas. Fortunately, he didn't listen to me. So turns out, yes, you can find something more interesting, and there is an interesting way out of this constraint. The way to do it is to, let's just revisit edge of a topological insulator, the original Fouquet idea as opposed to the way it was actually done in Delft, and ask ourselves a question. What if you had a fractional topological insulator here? Well, that's an interesting question, but I don't know how to answer it. Well, I know how to answer it, but it's not the direction in which we started thinking, because partly I'm not so interested because so far there are no fractional topological insulators. But what you can do is you can effectively fake this physics of a fractional topological insulator in quantum Hall systems. So here we go back to the quantum Hall systems. And from what you already learned, from what I already told you about the quantum Hall, imagine the following situation. You have two quantum Hall droplets, both at nu equals 1. So far, it's the integer quantum Hall state. And these are the chiral edge states, basically the caricatures of your skipping orbits. Well, so the skipping orbits are the caricatures of these edge states. And now, if you zoom into this, so these are two states. And suspend your disbelief for a second and imagine that I can prepare these quantum Hall states with the opposite value of the G factor. That means that I would actually have opposite polarization of spins in these two states. And now if you zoom into this region, what you would see is that you have two counterpropagating modes with the opposite direction of spin. That basically, ignoring the rest of the physics, that's just like the edge of a two-dimensional topological insulator. And so you can actually then play the same game, assuming you could induce superconductivity and put something that would provide a different kind of gap, that is a ferromagnetic insulator here. And then, of course, on the boundary of that, what you should find is these Majorana zero modes. Now, in fact, because there is no time reversal symmetry here to begin with, you already have a strong magnetic field, you don't really need anything to break the time reversal symmetry. All you need is something that would provide for the backscattering of one edge into the other. Anything that has a non-zero matrix element for tunneling of an electron from one, from the red edge to the blue edge would do. An insulator with a strong spin orbit coupling, for example. Now, let me actually spend a minute and talk to you a little bit about the anatomy of this Majorana zero mode, because it will be you'll see why this is important. So basically what I'm doing now is I'm zooming in this into this domain wall between a superconductor and well, whatever, quote unquote ferromagnet, where the backscattering, it's just basically the region where the backscattering is allowed. So what happens there is that if you start with an electron that moves to the right, let's move it to the right, the moment it reaches something where the backscattering is allowed, oops, wrong way, it will backscatter and go back. Now, what does a superconductor do? A superconductor allows for Andreev scattering. What that means is that an electron can scatter as a hole, leaving a Cooper pair behind. A hole will bounce back at this point, go back, Andreev scatter into an electron, and notice that you started where, so you ended where you started, with an electron going in this direction. Now, think about what you've seen here. You've seen here a superposition of four states, which consist of an electron and a hole. So this is, in some sense, a standing wave that is half electron, half hole. And I told you that's what a Majorana zero mode is. It's a superposition of an electron and a hole, and you've seen basically all moving parts corresponding to that. An electron converted, being converted into a hole by superconductor and vice versa. So now let's imagine what would happen if we looked at the nu equals 1/3 Laughlin state instead of nu equals 1 Laughlin state. Well, that state also has an edge state. If you can, you can think of this as basically a skipping edge, but not for electrons, but for Laughlin quasiparticles, which are fractionally charged. And we already saw the reason for why they should be fractionally charged. And now, if you try to play the same game, I'm claiming, without a proof that would actually exceed the time allotted for this talk, but the interesting objects that you find. So you still find zero modes here, but the zero modes are not Majoranas. They're so-called parafermions, and these are the apparatus that, so for the Maya runners, the rules are the following. You have the square of the apparator is equal to 1, and the apparators have the normal fermionic, the different Maya runner fermions have normal fermionic commutation relations. But parafermions are a generalization of that where the power is not 2, but could be any integer. So these are Zn parafermions that were originally introduced in the context of classical and then quantum clock models by as far as 1980 by Fratnin and Cardanov, and recently revived in the purely quantum context by Paul Findlay. Oh, I should have put the real citation, but well, anyway, you can find Paul's papers online if you're interested in the subject. So the nth power is equal to 1, and the commutation relation between the two is not fermionic and it's not bosonic. It's actually kind of funny. It has this power in it, and it also suggests that 1D is the only place where you can naturally look for them, because in order to have this commutation relations, you see that the apparators have to be naturally ordered. It's only n equals 2 that gets you out of this, because minus 1 is, and 1 over minus 1 is still the same number, but it's not the case for any other n. Anyway, so my claim is that the what you find here are the apparators, the zero modes, that generalized Maya runner fermions with these really funny rules. Now, yes? Well, it's kind of important, and I didn't stress that, that a superconductor is a normal superconductor. It can only Cooper pair electrons. And the only particles that can scatter from one edge to another are electrons as well, because there is a trench in between. There is no way in which E over 3 quasi-particles are actually defined anywhere outside of the liquid. So, so E over 3 particles can only participate in superconductivity if you collect 6 of them. Then that happens. And in fact, in this case, you get so-called Z6 parafermions. And the 6 corresponds to this exactly fact, that until you collect 6 of these quasi-particles, you cannot go back to the original state. For Maya runners, it required 2 electrons to disappear into a superconductor. For these, you need 6 of them. And that's what actually makes the nature of these zero modes here non-trivial. But a superconductor is a normal superconductor. It's a superconductor of electrons. And the backscattering here is also a normal backscattering of electrons and nothing else. I'm not allowing, and I shouldn't be allowing, backscattering of Laughlin quasi-particles over the region that is not a quantum Hall region. You assume that proximity affects six electrons only, yeah. So it's yeah, in the language, in the bosonized language that I didn't throw here, it corresponds to the term cosine of 6 phi, which means that it only pairs 6 quasi-particles. All right, so now if you want to look at the anatomy of this, it's a little bit more complicated. So you start with 1 over m particle. It comes here. And as I told you, you cannot bounce it back as a particle, because only electrons can bounce. But what can happen is that it can leave a dipole, if you wish, an electron in a hole bound at this side. It cannot disappear into an insulating part, because that one is gapped. But now, this particle came here. It cannot Andreev scatter. But what can happen is it can release a quasi-hole and leave a this sort of 2 quasi-particles sitting here. Now, a quasi-hole annihilated this quasi-particle, releasing a quasi-hole. And you're back to where you started. So if you wish, a picture now is a little bit more complicated, because for the time being, you actually have some leftover sitting at the edges, but the nature is nevertheless very similar. And you can, I mean, this is not just a naive picture. There is a calculation behind it. You can actually construct explicitly an apparator that commutes with a Hamiltonian, and it will consist of quasi-particle and quasi-hole excitations moving in both directions. So so each of these pictures corresponded to a particular term in the apparator that that one can construct. So just to give you a very quick upshot of what we have done is basically generalizing the Fouquet construction from my runners to be able to get these parafermionic operators on the domain wall between superconductors and something that allows backscattering here between different Laughlin states. And while for the Meyer runners, the actual degeneracy was really the degeneracy of a superconducting region with respect to adding an extra fermion. And of course, so that's even odd number of fermions in a superconductor. Here, the degeneracy would be six-fold degenerate, and it's the degeneracy with respect to adding Laughlin quasiparticles to the superconducting region, until you add six of them, at which point they can disappear in superconductor and you are back to the original state. You're in different states. And so that's the, if you wish, the nature of this six-fold degeneracy. Yeah. It's exponential in the number of zero modes. So for each two zero modes, here you get two. That's basically in that sense you have the degeneracy of square root of two per Majorana mode. Here you would get a degeneracy of square root of six per parafermionic mode. So it is exponential with the number of modes that you place there. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so n equals 2 is my runner. So, but n is, so the n is equal to 2m. So that would correspond to the integer quantum Hall case. So if I put integer quantum Hall states here, I would get my runners. But if I put fractional quantum Hall states, I get something more interesting. Say it again. No, it's n equals 2. M is equal to 1. So n is equal to 2m. So for the 1/3 case, I get n equals 6 parafermions. I guess it's like you have a bosonic. Oh, bosonic. Yeah. Perhaps didn't think about it. I mean, n equals 4, I don't see anything that prevents me from doing that. All right, so there are some, one of the predictions originally made by Alexei Kitaev in his paper for the Majorana as the signature would be a fractional Josephson effect that tells you that the energy of, let's say, the any of the superconductors. So as you twist the phases of superconducting regions, you need to twist the phase by 4 pi rather than 2 pi to come back to the original state. And that is because you need to account for the fermionic parity inside. If you twist the phase by 2 pi, the fermionic parity inside will only will switch from even to odd or vice versa, and you need to do it twice in order to restore the original state, and that leads to so-called fractional Josephson effect. Fractional is a bit of a misnomer because it's actually a multiple periodicity. It's 4 pi rather than 2 pi. So in our case, by the same token, the periodicity would be 2m times 2 pi. So this would be a, what is this? So it's 6 times 2 pi Laughlin, Josephson effect, if you could construct this thing. But let me actually talk a little bit about some idea and cute circuit elements that I promised to tell you about. But for that, let me actually spend 1 second and talk about possible experimental realizations, and you'll see where I'm heading. Let's address the question of whether any of this is feasible. So one immediate sticky point is putting something with different G factors. It turns out you don't need to look for the opposite G factors. There are some interesting states that you can exploit other than simple Laughlin states, such as spin unpolarized 2/3 or 2/5 state. And it turns out that then you get real parafermions with actually n equals not 6 or 10, as you would expect, but actually 3 or 5 here. And you don't need, so the interesting thing about this spin unpolarized state is that they already have the both spins present in them. And so you don't need any other states to flip the spin. So it can be done internally in some sense. And in that case, you actually don't need an insulator. So a picture like this would still work, where you have an edge that is then being folded over the trench and proximitized by a superconductor. You would find parafermionic modes where this edge just gets out of a superconductor. And now let me actually zoom and exploit this kind of design. So let's assume that everything inside here is this nu equals 2/3 or 2/5 quantum Hall state. You, as I said, kind of scratched a part of your two-dimensional electron gas, dug a trench here, if you wish, so that the edge has to go around it, and you put a superconductor here that provides for the electron pairing. Now, what happens is that you have one localized zero mode here, and another one, if you wish, well, lives, that's the other zero mode that lives outside of the superconducting region. And the important thing for us, let's go back if I can, and apparently I can't. The important thing for us, I'm stuck here, so I can't go back. So the important thing that the superconductor does is it provides for Andreev reflection. That's something I already mentioned. So just to review, a conventional Andreev reflection is, well, this is just conventional reflection. That's an electron comes and bounces back as an electron. Andreev reflection is when an electron comes, leaves a Cooper pair in a superconductor, and leaves back as a hole. And that actually doubles the conductivity of this one-dimensional system with respect to just a single electron channel, because effectively a charge of 2 E got transferred to the right. In our case, what's really interesting is that the edge is chiral. So under normal circumstances, an electron coming to a superconductor would bounce back as a hole, but it cannot, because the only direction in which the charge can propagate is forward. And so what it means that the hole should be shooting in the same direction in which the electron came. And that sometimes, so I think some people refer to this as crossed Andreev reflection. We call it an Andreev conversion. The important thing is that, of course, if you look at the current balance, you would find that there is a current flowing here, but then this corresponds to the current flowing also towards the superconductor. That means that the superconductor, of course, has to absorb Cooper pairs, and the current should flow out of it. And that's an interesting bit of a circuitry, and we can start playing with it. So let me imagine the... a superconductor will collect them until it can combine them into a Cooper pair, and only after that they can... you can play this carefully. I'm playing it loose right now. So you're absolutely right that a superconductor cannot absorb, cannot actually get anything other than Cooper pairs outside. But basically what that means, it has to wait for three of these particles to form a Cooper pair, and then that Cooper pair disappears. Let me just do a little bit of conventional, almost conventional Kirchhoff rule calculations. So what I'm looking is basically a current, an edge current flowing this way, some edge current here, and an edge and a current getting out of a superconductor, let's say, back into the ground. And one thing I can do is I can basically ask myself, what should be the voltages across this? What should be the relative potential of the lower edge with respect to the upper edge? Well, that's kind of easy, because if I completely ignore this superconducting bit, that's a quantum Hall liquid. So I know that the current that flows should actually be equal to simply sigma H times the voltage across this the sample. And the voltage is, well, the conductivity is given by, well, whatever quantum Hall state I'm dealing with. And it's basically pinned. On the other hand, I also know that the current that flows into the superconductor is half of the total current that flows out of the superconductor because there is a an opposite one coming from the other side. And so that means that the current that gets out here is actually 2 sigma h times v. That's really equivalent to this doubled conductivity of a wire with Andreev reflection because of the Andreev reflection itself. It doubles the current that flows there. And so once you play with this, so on one hand, it should be sigma h times v. On the other hand, it's sigma h v bottom minus v top. What you realize is that if this piece of a superconductor is grounded, then the solution is rather simple. If the voltage at the bottom is v, the voltage at the top should be minus v. And now, guided with this, you can start cooking up various, or at least imagine various circuit elements that you can build out of this. One circuit element is, in all of this, I'm assuming the following. I'm assuming that equilibration and energy dissipation occur only at the normal lead, and that basically the edges are completely dissipationless, and of course, the superconductor is. So here are some ideas for the interesting circuit elements that you can make out of this. So you can make something with four. So the picture here is kind of a caricature now. I'm not really drawing this folded edge underneath each superconducting lead, but it's kind of hidden there. All I'm doing is basically assuming that I'm trying to run the current, and now I'm trying to put voltages according to the rules I've just devised in this picture. And you'll see that, for example, in this four-terminal case, I should be able to run current between this lead and this lead only if I provide a circuit for the current to run in the top leads. Or otherwise, there will be a voltage buildup here, and basically it will block the entire system. So that's kind of a cute non-local prediction for what may happen in this case. Oh, by the way, if you try to do it with three leads, you can't do it, because basically you see that if you try to follow the paths for, well, what happens to an electron as it converts itself into a hole upon each Andreev reflection, you'll see that you immediately run into contradiction. So a three leads device should not conduct any current at zero voltage between any of the two leads. But here is even a more interesting. Basically, you can play with all these Kirchhoff rules and see what happens, for example, if you have a four lead device and ground the top and the bottom ones. And once again, going through all these rules, you would have to figure out that whatever you feed into this lead should be, you should feed an equal amount into the opposite side. That basically means that it serves as a mirror for the current. So, or otherwise, once again, you cannot run current in this device. And in a three-terminal device, well, what you get is you get if you wish, a transformer, the current transformer, where the amount that you get in order to be able to run the current here, well, you have to build up voltages, and then the amount of the current out would be equal to 2 sigma h times the voltage that you applied here. So these are not your usual circuit elements, but let me show one more amusing circuit element that you can build. And that is, so imagine this being a quantum hole droplet at, let's say, nu equals 1/3, as I mentioned. And I'm trying, so I'm building two of these superconducting leads with the trenches underneath them, and I'm connecting them by a superconducting ring. And this is a normal lead, and I'm trying to bias these two leads with voltage V. So we assume that the voltage is inherited by the downstream edge. So the electrons, that this is a chiral edge, so the electrons or quasi-particles can only go in one direction. So whatever voltage is supplied to this normal lead is the voltage inherited by the downstream lead. And then, once again, playing the game with the rules I just described, you can then put the voltages. So if this is V and this is the superconducting trench, I told you that this has to be minus V because this is grounded at zero. But then for this, the voltage should be V once again. So what that means is that this edge and this edge at exactly the same potential, that means that there is actually no current that you are feeding into the normal lead. So this provides a voltage bias, but it feeds no current into the quantum hole droplet because the top and the bottom edges are at the same voltage. And then what it means that the only current that flows is actually flowing in this device. So what you've managed to achieve is to couple voltage to the flux. I think the word for that would be a flux capacitor. Basically, I think somebody else thought about this before us, but we just stole the device. Still working on how to plug it further into the into a time machine. So let me just let me give you basically a very quick preliminary. Oh, sorry. Who this guy is? So the thing is that none of what I describe actually relies on the statistics, and that's what I meant before. So basically, if you notice that once I started talking about the circuit elements, the commutation relations are not important. What is important, really, is the fact that I can do the Andreev reflection with the chiral edge.
It could be a Majorana.
So in principle, it could be a Majorana. It turns out that nu equals 2. So it's not obvious to me how you'll make it work with Majorana. So if you could, so basically what you need is some kind of, I kind of skipped the important details. One of the important details about, let's say, nu equals 2/3 state is that the reconstructed with the 2/3 state with edge reconstruction has one charge mode and one spin mode. And so basically you have a single chiral charge mode with a charge 2/3, which you can then proximitize. It carries no spin, so you can proximitize it easily by a superconductor. So now if you wanted to play the same game with Majoranas, what you would need is nu equals 2 state, which for some reasons would be reconstructed in such a way that you had a charge mode and a spin mode. So basically you need two co-propagating nu equals one states, and then you could make, I don't know how to make it physically. Conceptually, you can think of something like this. But practically, and it turns out that 2/3 actually hits a very important sweet spot. It's the sweet spot between the interactions being relevant, so you can actually expect this reconstruction to happen, and superconducting coupling being relevant, so you actually expect the effective proximity coupling. 2/5, I think, has harder time being proximitized, so you need some strong coupling limit. But anyway, so it becomes a game of how effective these couplings will be in a real system. These are details I didn't really address, but anyway. So 2/3 seems to be the best choice of what we could think. And moreover, this spin unpolarized 2/3 state actually exists. We know that experimentally has been found in the 90s, but basically left there because nobody knew what to do with it. So we now know what to do with it. Two-thirds. There are two 2/3 states, spin polarized and spin unpolarized. And we need the unpolarized one. That's the one that is observed at weaker magnetic fields. So in fact, back in the 90s, Jim Eisenstein, among other people, saw the transition. I mean, they saw the transitions between these two states. They even measured NMR, so the spin polarization of these states and so on. But anyway, sorry, you had a question.
Do these parabolians have some kind of fusion rules and the impossible circuits that you're talking about? Can they be explained in terms of violating the fusion rules?
By the fusion rule, you mean anionic fusion rules?
Yeah.
The only fusion rule that you need to count is basically based on counting charge. Yeah. So no other. So for the circuitry that I described, the only thing that is important is counting charge and nothing else. So I really did not exploit any of the non-abelian natures of. So it turns out that these parafermions are actually non-abelian anions in some loosely defined sense. I was already quoting Bill Clinton today that it depends. So whether or not these are non-abelian anions depends upon what your definition of the word is. Well, basically, these parafermions are not free particles or free quasi-particles. They are not low-energy excitations of any physical systems. These are objects that are tight, bound to domain walls, which are very high energy. I mean, domain walls between anything are not a part of your low-energy physics. And so in that sense, you can actually work out the non-abelian statistics between them, but that, strictly speaking, should be referred to as projective statistics, because basically the moment you start moving high-energy objects, there is a completely uncontrolled dynamical phase so the non-abelian part is still well-defined, and that's what I mean by projective statistics, but you have absolutely no chance of recovering the corresponding abelian piece of the statistics for these excitations. So indeed, they are non-abelian. We actually worked it out. Let me very quickly mention that. So now I'm in minus 4 minutes of my talk, but let me just. Maybe I shouldn't mention anything about their use. I should just say that what I told you about had something to do, some cute circuit elements that kind of built on these non-abelian anions, but what they really use is not their non-abelian statistics, but rather their anatomy that is built on the fact that a superconductor provides this Andreev reflection, and when you couple this Andreev reflection to a chiral edge that forces, let's say, positive charge come from one side and spits a negative charge in the opposite direction, that basically is the important ingredient for everything I told you about. So in principle, we can visualize, great future, including the time machines, of course. But I think it might be important that it's actually provides a new transport signature of non-abelian zero modes. So I should say that it doesn't really prove their non-abelian nature, but it's kind of an interesting signature of these modes being there. And it's very hard to imagine some other mechanisms giving these funny signatures. And yeah, so that's something I could think of as a new use of non-abelian anions that doesn't necessarily employ their non-abelian nature, but as I said, employs their anatomy. So I guess I should thank you for attention. Let me just go to the my very, very, very last slide. Oh, well, maybe not very last, but just like this. I can't blow it up. So I just wanted to show the pictures of my collaborators, David Clark and Jason Alicia. I don't know how to make it big without going to the first page. Let's see if I succeed. Just a 5 doesn't work on me. That's what I'm pushing. Yeah. See? That's right. All right. So thank you very much. Ah, very good question. So it turns out that the answer is, in the hindsight, almost trivial and is known to high energy people for a long time. So what we are exploiting here is not a one-dimensional system. It's a one-dimensional domain wall. And one thing that has been known, for example, by people who were trying to find, build chiral fermions, you cannot have them in two dimensions, but you can have them on a domain wall between different three-dimensional media. So domain walls are richer than systems. So one-dimensional domain walls are richer than just genuinely one-dimensional systems.
Is there an underlying
classification of the domain wall? No, there isn't at this point. But it's precisely that gets us out of the classification. The fact that the system itself is not one-dimensional, and that's kind of important. So we're exploiting the two-dimensional topological order that is around it.
So when you take these two, let's say,
lock and conformal
states, what happens when you
see the Well, I mean, we do employ tunneling, right? So basically, so what you need, so these modes live on the domain wall between one part where you do have tunneling, electron tunneling between them, and on the other half, the side, you have superconductor. Now you're asking, well, what if you have both? Well, basically, the strongest one wins. So you just need a domain wall between a region where the tunneling dominates and the region where the superconducting proximity effect dominates.
But if you tunnel between one edge to the other,
but that's what I need. I need to tunnel electrons.
Yeah.
Well, so in what sense? So you don't reconstruct the quantum Hall liquid. So if you want the quantum Hall liquid to kind of repair itself, what you need is to allow the quasiparticle tunneling. But that is impossible if you actually have the vacuum region between them. So in fact, once again, I didn't go into the details of that, but we do exploit the fact that the two-third edge, the one that we are using, is edge reconstructed, because instead of having really one-third with spin up and one-third with spin down, what you get is pure charge and pure spin. You can forget about pure spin and just concentrate on what the pure charge is doing. So we do employ edge reconstruction as a part of this. I just didn't focus on it.